Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
TRE in the afternoon, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Women Talk. It's just gone 5 past 5. With me in the studio now, we have Laurie Knight, Kaylee Parkinson and Sandra Mole. Hello.
Hello.
Thank you all for coming in. If you are listening at home and you'd like to get involved, you absolutely can. Here's how.
To contact TRE, please call 952 78 4000. Email studio at tre.radio. Send us a WhatsApp on +34 645 99 67 95.
What a beautiful day.
Okay, we're starting off with some small talk. I thought this was a good place to start. The article says, as a nation, we are said to be very good at it, but research suggests that we may no longer be the masters of small talk. Some 88% of Britons find it difficult and awkward to chat to strangers. The main concerns revolve around never knowing what to speak about, feeling self-conscious and worrying about saying something stupid. So how do we feel about small talk?
Well, I've never met anyone who doesn't know how to small talk. I can be in a shop, a supermarket,
yeah,
and people will come up to me. I've had life stories just buying something in a supermarket. I must admit, I'm probably the same because I talk to everybody on an aeroplane.
Yeah, but it's not. You like small talk then?
Yeah.
Well, find it easy.
I don't think it's small talk. It's very, very important.
Yes, exactly.
I'm the complete opposite.
Really?
I find it really difficult to talk to people that I don't know. That I've to find something in common with people, and I hate people on aeroplanes who talk.
Well, luckily there's someone in between us.
Brilliant. So you wouldn't go out there to make small talk, you'd keep yourself to yourself?
No, I would try, but I find it very difficult.
Yeah.
It's not natural to me. If I have something in common with somebody, then that's great, but
yeah,
actually finding that thing in common is hard for me. I like to walk into a room and stand back and just weigh up the situation. And yeah, but no, it's difficult for me.
Yeah.
What about that thing that we hear, it's always easier to offload to a stranger?
Yeah.
Which is a bit like small talk, getting rid of everything, isn't it?
Yeah. Would you do that, Laurie?
Yeah, I would talk to a stranger if I was in the mood.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd have to be in the mood, but yeah.
So maybe small talk just depends on the mood.
Yeah, I think so. Definitely for me, sometimes I'm really in the mood to be chatty and I'll spark up a conversation with a stranger on an aeroplane or something. Oh, hey, where are you off to? Or in the queue, and it's nice. And other times I really... It's not that I feel uncomfortable, I just can't be bothered.
Yes.
I think, you know, I do a lot of talking in my life and in my job. Sometimes I think I don't really want to talk to anyone today.
Do I find that
I'm quite happy to...
people's faces, when you look at them, they're inviting. And other people are off-putting, so I think that has a big effect on how you talk.
Definitely. Yeah. If you're in a queue and someone kind of, I don't know, you're standing there for ages and someone turns around and, you know, raises their eyes or whatever, then it's, you know, almost an invitation to say, I can't
that
believe
must,
how long
that
we've
must
been
be
standing.
Laurie.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It does make a difference, doesn't it? You can tell that sometimes the people that maybe don't want to talk, or the people that are open for it.
I love small talk, but then I find I've got verbal diarrhea because I'm trying to fill the silence.
Yes, it's stopping, isn't it?
Yeah.
Once you start, then you think, oh, let's just talk about something else. Yes, very true. Okay, lateness. For many of us, being late is considered the height of rudeness, a sign of disrespect, even contempt for those you keep waiting. But not so for Generation Z, who believe showing up 10 minutes late is almost as good as being on time. Almost half, 46% of those aged 16 to 26, say being 5 to 10 minutes late is perfectly acceptable, just as good as being punctual.
Well, I think the fact that they're late is because they're Z, which is the end of the alphabet anyway. I can't stand people being late.
No.
Especially when they are consistently 20 minutes late.
Yes.
I think, why is their time more valuable than our time?
Yeah. I think everybody's
got one of those friends that you know they are always going to be late, always going to be late, and you expect them to be late, so you tell them half an hour
an earlier.
Earlier
time, yes.
And your friend.
We have a friend who is consistently an hour sooner.
An hour earlier?
An hour. And will telephone us or WhatsApp us and say, I'm here. And even when we said later, she still manages to be...
So that works both ways.
That's just as annoying, though.
Yeah. I always like to let people know if I... Because I really desperately try to be on time because I can't stand lateness. But if there is... You know, this is why I like mobile phones in a way that we didn't have them before, to be able to say, really sorry, running a few minutes late or whatever. And I will. If I'm going to be, like, 2 minutes late, I'll send a message.
But don't you think that's a bit of an excuse? Because I don't remember ever being late when we were younger without mobile phones.
No, absolutely.
We just made sure we were there.
Yeah. And there's so many different, you know, we can blame traffic, which obviously can play a massive factor, or things going wrong, losing keys, you know, all the kind of valid reasons, if you like, for people to be late. But people who are never late will always kind of explain that if you're organised and make sure you give yourself enough time, if you know that there could be traffic on the journey that you're going to, if you know that you're not sure where your keys are and you need to make sure you've got your, you know, all these different things that you can kind of do to prepare to ensure you're never late. If some people are capable of doing that, then it proves that it is possible.
I would rather leave early and sit in the car till it was time to go in.
I'm ex-army, so it was drilled into me. You have a time to be somewhere, you're there 5 minutes early.
Yeah.
And that is still true today.
Yeah, there you go. It's possible. How do you feel about lateness?
I'm late to everything.
Are you at work?
Yeah, everywhere, yeah. I think it's getting ready. I don't plan enough time to get ready to leave. And like you say, then you've lost your keys, your phone's dead, or, yeah, things just creep up and get in the way.
Yeah.
Did Hannah tell you to get here at 3 o'clock?
Yes,
she came with me.
She
came with army pants.
Straight orders.
Okay, one more before the break. How working from home won't make you more productive. Rolling out of bed for a Zoom call makes employees happier than going into the office, but research shows that it doesn't make them more productive. Working on a hybrid schedule, so like 3 days in the office and two at home, resulted in staff enjoying their jobs more, but it failed to increase output. A hybrid schedule with 2 days a week working from home does not damage performance, interestingly, but there was no productivity boost, which they said could have been due to fewer of face-to-face interactions. How do we feel about working from home?
I think that that for me it's a bonus. If you're enjoying your job, that's a bonus. Productivity hasn't gone down. What's to lose?
Yeah.
And I think it's retention as well. They tend to stay longer if they're happier.
Mm-hmm. True.
I think it's a difficult one. I get to work from home if needed, but I choose to be in the office because I obviously prefer being around people. I like socialising that comes with being in the office. But then there's things that you've got, I don't know, a dinner at 5 o'clock and you finish at 4:30 and you can't get home, get ready in time. So working from home on that day is perfect. Do you get distracted and do things around the house? Quite possibly. But I think it's a healthy balance. It's a nice work-life balance, I think.
Yeah. It's nice to have the option,
I suppose. Absolutely.
Yeah, but if you've had that option and you do all the things, it has shown the research that their productivity doesn't fall. So it's irrespective that you do your dishes or washing, put it on while you're working, as long as you get it done.
Yeah. I wonder how honest people are sometimes about whether they're distracted or not, because most people working from home kind of say, oh, I mean, they are, if they are getting the work done, then there's your argument. They'll say, well, I'm doing as much work as I would do if I was in the office. I'm getting more done. I'm able to concentrate, all that kind of stuff. But I don't know. There's no way of monitoring it.
But have you seen in the office how many people have their mobile phones under the desk?
Oh,
and you think they're working and they're just tapping away. So is it putting the washing on, tapping on your mic, on your mobile? What's the difference?
Yeah. No, definitely. Definitely. As long as they're producing the same amount of work.
Exactly.
But it does make a difference, I guess, with interaction in the office. As you say, Kaylee, you don't get that when you're at home. And that could make a difference depending on the job and the environment. You know, there's less kind of creativity happening, discussions between people in the office. If you're at home, you're never.
I think the hybrid method is the best, you know, half and half.
Doing a bit of both.
I agree, yeah. Mm.
Moving on to the next one. We'll do one more before the break. This we talked about with the guys last week. I thought it would be interesting to get your thoughts on it. So this isn't anything to do with the political side of things. This isn't about your opinions on Gaza and the situation there. It's to do with your opinions on celebrities giving their opinions on big political things that are happening in the world. So the headline reads, how celebrities are being sent to the digitine, that's digital guillotine, by the social media mob if they dare to stay silent on Gaza. So people are saying that they want the celebrities that they follow to put forth their opinion on social media on how they feel about big political things that are happening in the world. I personally completely disagree with that. I feel like if I'm following, you know, looking at Instagram, for example, if I'm following a political person or somebody to do with news, then I expect I'm following them for that particular reason and I expect their opinions on things like that. But if I'm following someone because I like the bikini she wears and I like the places she goes on holiday and the cocktails that she drinks, if she suddenly gives me a political opinion that I disagree with, then I'm likely to think, oh, I don't really, not sure if I'm
I don't care whether I agree with them or disagree with them. Unless they are in an ambassadorial role, you know, like a children's representative or something, and they have a right to be speaking on that subject, that's fine. But otherwise, no. And I don't think that we should be having this bullying coming from the people, just, you know, persuading everyone to say what they want, because they're only saying that because they want their opinions to come forward.
Yeah. I would question where their opinions have come from if they're just jumping on the bandwagon thinking, oh, it's fashionable to say you like this political party, or, you know, everyone's saying, talking about Just Stop Oil, so it's fashionable to say, you know, without actually really understanding where their opinion has coming from. If they give an opinion and there's lots of reasons, factual reasons that they have to back up that opinion, then I might think, oh, fair play, they've done their research. I might not necessarily agree with them, but I appreciate why they've got this opinion, as opposed to just...
There are different levels as well. I mean, I don't mind how many celebrities condemn Trump, but but it depends on the level of, you know, what they're talking about. They're talking about a whole nation, talking about a war. It's very difficult, because where does their personal opinion come in and the celebrity opinion come in?
And how many celebrities have had their careers disrupted or destroyed because they've had opinions on something that it really wasn't relevant to their jobs or you know, it's difficult. It's
I'd be nervous.
It's a personal opinion, and not everybody agrees with your opinions.
No. I think they're safer not to give their opinion, aren't they, really?
There's so much trolling on social media, especially Instagram, for example, that I think it's easier to stay quiet, because you can't do right for doing wrong when you give an opinion on there, because trolls will jump on and criticise you for that.
That's what they're being criticised for, isn't it? Staying silent.
Yeah. I think
they should still err on that side, though. Silence is better.
I really do think so. I think it could go all kinds of wrong if they do speak out, especially on issues that are so divisive that they could suddenly lose a load of followers and lose a load of likes, because people say, how can they have that opinion?
Well, and world leaders don't even know what they're doing.
No.
So how can a celebrity in a bikini know?
Exactly. Okay, we better take a break.
Hannah Murray on TRE in the afternoon.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Women Talk. With me in the studio today, Laurie Knight, Kayleigh Parkinson and Sandra Mole. This is the headline, My Shock Diagnosis and How I'm Blowing Every Penny of My £1 Million Fortune. A lady has written this article who's saying, for the past 8 months, I've been renting an apartment for £4,000 a month, eating at fancy restaurants a few times a week and spending £400 on designer shoes without a thought. I'd never have classed myself as a big spender before, but after finding out I have 10 years to live, I plan to enjoy life to the fullest without worrying about the price tag. So she decided to sell her three-story townhouse in North London that she'd lived in for 32 years as she was struggling to climb the stairs. She's decided to rent with a decade left. She says, what would be the point in tying up all the money I had in a purchase? The estate agent showed her a luxury rental in Wapping, East London, and she fell in love. It was on the Thames, all glass, with incredible view of the Shard and Tower Bridge. Her house sold for £1 million, and she started doing the maths of how much she'd need to enjoy each year of the rest of her life. She says, I don't have any family to give my money to, so I had 10 years to blow my budget.
What Go do we girl.
Think? That was totally my reaction as well.
Absolutely.
What a marvellous way to deal with a negative diagnosis. Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant.
If somebody could tell me how long I'd got left, I would do exactly the same.
Yeah.
What, sell your house for £1 million?
Yeah. I mean, I think my only concern with this is that
she lives for 11 years.
Not being funny, doctors get things wrong. I know people personally who were told they'd have 3 months, 6 months, a year, whatever, and had 5 years, 10 years. So she can't
lose Hannah because she's having a good time. So she's got 10 years of absolute marvellous time.
She could lose money. I don't understand how a doctor can say you've got 10 years. I mean, that's a massive amount of time. She could have 15 years, 20 years.
The pacemaker, whatever they've put into her, only lasts for 10 years.
Oh, and so that's guaranteed 10 years. Oh, I'm
and
sorry.
And that's what it said in the article.
Oh, fair enough then.
So okay. She's working on that. And
okay.
What a way to go.
Yeah.
Isn't that what we all say? We don't want to burn out. We want to flame out. You know?
Yes, exactly. I love that. One of my things, there was a story shared on social media the other day, which I've seen so many times before, people who kind of retire on cruise ships and basically spend the rest of their lives on the cruise ship. They've got healthcare, they've got food, they've got all their travel. They've got people making their beds every day. They've got everything they could possibly want.
It's cheaper than a sheltered home.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you wake up in a different country every day.
Yeah. Wow. That is my dream.
Absolutely.
Dying on a cruise ship.
You don't have to pay for your funeral. Yeah. They just throw you overboard.
Fine. Happy with that.
Win-win.
I think that's absolutely brilliant. The first story I saw on that was years ago now, and it was a lady who'd lost her husband and a lot of her friends, but she still amazingly had her health. She was still she had her mobility and everything, so she was able to do it. I mean, that's the thing. Obviously, if you've got lots of health issues, then you wouldn't be able to do it. So you have to do it at the right kind of time in your life. But she didn't have any kind of commitments and off she went.
But
do you think
this lady's got it? I mean, the moral of her story is enjoy whatever time you've got left. Yes. You don't have to have £1 million. You can live according to what you have, but make the most of it.
Definitely.
And do anything you can to be happy.
Definitely. It's a great message. It sounds really obvious, doesn't it? It really does. But so many people don't do it. We're kind of worried about all money and many things to worry about.
But we don't know how she got to that stage. She may have gone through that. What's happening to me? All the negative bit first, and then came to that with a bit of help, probably.
Yeah. But I mean, you hear all the awful stories of people who have worked really hard in a job all their life. A lot of the time, it's a job that they don't even like, with people they don't like, and then they retire, and then they get seriously ill, or even worse, die. And that's been their life.
Isn't that what they worked on when they developed the welfare state, that people weren't going to live that long, and hence the retirement age was less because the people died 4 or 5 years after retiring.
Yeah. That's really sad, isn't it? Because you kind of grow up thinking, oh, when I retire, I'm going to do this and this. You just imagine that when you retire, you'll automatically have this big pot of money and then you can start travelling around the world. And
like us baby boomers. We're the lucky ones, aren't we?
It does happen with some, but not others. It all depends on different lifestyle choices one makes through their lives. But I don't know. I've always kind of, maybe to my detriment, but lived the kind of life I've wanted to live as much as I could with the money I've had at the time. I've never been much of a saver, and I've started to do that more in the last few years or so. But I've been a bit more, have a bit of money, well, let's do something nice and kind of spend it. And
but you're also lucky that you do a job that you love.
Yes.
Yeah. It makes a big difference in life.
Yeah, definitely. But I've had friends in the past that hardly ever do anything, spend any money, and save, you know, have most of their wages literally for years in the bank, you know, they pay what they need to pay on rent and whatever, but hardly ever go out spending any money because it's just been drilled into them from a young age, save. But they're kind of not having much of a social life.
And they don't even know what they're saving for.
No, absolutely.
Because if you're saving for something, you get that amount that you need and then you buy it or do it, whatever it is.
Yeah.
That's different.
I do that. I save for a purpose, spend it, and then start saving again for another.
Mm. Well, you can't take it with you, so enjoy it whilst you've got it.
Life's too short. Absolutely. It's a balance, isn't it?
Which is
what we all need to get to grips with everything. Like, food's a balance. Everything's a... Life is a balance. This made me laugh. I've got to be careful how I say this. Meet the Dinkwads. Stands for double income, no kids, with a dog. So that's what it stands for. They make up 15%... Dual income, no kids, with a dog, couples make up 15% of dog owners in the UK. This legion of pairs both earn a decent wage, are childless, and dote on at least one pampering pooch. Nearly half admit to delaying parenthood in favour of their furry companions. Dog owners found that half of dinkwads will actively choose a holiday or staycation where they can take their dog, and 44% admit to preferring spending quality time with their dog to going out with friends.
What are their friends like?
Well, yeah, exactly. I have noticed a lot more in recent years, people bringing dogs to cafes and restaurants and
everywhere. Dogs, and they've got coats on and they've got little ribbons in their hair. I'm not sure.
No.
More or less a fashion accessory now,
yes,
isn't it?
So. Very much so.
We were walking along the Paseo the other day and someone was actually carrying their golden retriever.
Oh, no.
Seriously.
That's silly. I'm not a huge fan of dogs in restaurants, to be honest.
No, nope.
Around food and things.
I love dogs, but I don't want them next to me while I'm eating.
No.
Nope, absolutely not, no.
I don't mind if they're under the table. Some dogs are so quiet and under the table,
yeah,
and I don't mind that. But if they're a bit barky and begging,
And sometimes the smell as well.
Oh, definitely.
If they've been in the sea, maybe,
We were talking about this the other day. I've never had a dog, so I don't want to, you know. But people who have dogs don't always smell their own dogs,
yes,
do they?
Yeah.
That's kind of a thing. Mm. You get used to it. I guess the same with cats as well. I've never thought cats
partners too.
But you kind of get used to it, yeah, don't you? Which makes sense. But then other people will come into the house and will smell dogs,
yeah,
and other people won't. So it's an interesting one. So yeah, I think around food and stuff. And the problem is some dogs are okay and some dogs aren't. Mm. If you allow dogs into the vicinity, you have to allow all dogs. You can't go, I don't like the look of that
what
one.
What about
you
dogs can't... outside? Because nearly all our places have got terraces now, all the restaurants. I don't mind outside,
no,
as opposed
sure
to inside.
Yeah,
I mean, they're not in the kitchen. They're not preparing the food, are they?
No.
I hope.
I think as long as they're well-behaved, the problem I find with dog owners is they expect everybody to love their dog the way they
exactly,
love them.
Exactly, yes.
And not everybody likes dogs. Not everybody wants the dog there. Not everybody wants the dog wandering. It's a bit like children. Not everybody wants children running around
true
while they're eating.
Yeah,
I prefer them under the table as well.
It's true, isn't it? It's the assumption that
everybody loves dogs
will automatically love it.
Yeah.
I'm not saying I don't love dogs, by the way. It's just, when eating, not necessarily. So, yes, I think I am a dink whack then.
Oh, yes.
Cat person, dink whack, as opposed to dink wad. We better take another break.
Hannah Murray. TRE in the afternoon.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Women Talk with me in the studio today, Laurie Knight, Kaylee Parkinson and Sandra Mole. On to relationships. This is one that we talked about with the guys last week and I saved it to see what the ladies thought. Say it with flowers and poet's tips. Expressing our feelings to others can be a thorny issue, but one florist has the answer, a chief emotions translator to help relationships blossom. Research conducted by Interflora UK found that more than a third of people struggle with writer's block when they send flowers to loved ones, causing them to leave accompanying cards blank. To combat loneliness and create deeper connections, the firm has recruited a poet and writer called Chloe Laws to help customers speak from the heart. I can't imagine leaving the card blank. I mean, really?
Even if you did, surely.
Is it that difficult?
Well, even if you just say, with love. Yes. You can, I mean, you can say a sentence, surely.
Exactly. Happy birthday. Love you. I mean, it's not. Whatever the. Happy Mother's Day. I mean, whatever the situation is.
Isn't she? I think she's one of those card writers, you know, that makes you want to vomit when you read all of this. Yeah. You're the most wonderful person, especially. Oh, God.
But
yes,
it was too much.
You would know if your partner hadn't written that.
You know your
partner, unless it's somebody new that's trying to impress, maybe, but your partner, you would know.
I think you would.
It's not come from them. Yeah.
And would you like poetry if your partner wrote you poetry? Would that be nice?
It
just depends what it is. I mean, I'm romantic and I live writing things to my partner.
I'm a sucker for poetry, absolutely.
I don't know whether it's poetry, but I make it up.
Yes. I think it's nice.
I did once, after my friend's boyfriend at the time didn't know what to write, so I wrote it in the card for him, and then she said, he didn't write that. I know who it was.
She recognised your writing. Yes. Oh, brilliant. Yes. I think it's nice, a little bit of effort.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Where you can show that they've made an effort and they care enough to think about what is said. And it's why I kind of went off. I haven't sent Christmas cards for years because when I used to send Christmas cards, I used to want to write more than Happy Christmas, love Hannah. I kind of felt like. And everybody's different, and I get plenty of Christmas cards like that each year that are like that, and that's very lovely, and thank you very much. But me personally, I felt like I wanted to write more. I wanted to be more personal. And then I found it would take me ages as I was trying to think of something to write. You know, just, we've had lots of great times this year, looking forward to more, or, you know, something like that is nice. It's just a bit more personal, you know, thinking about writing something.
I do that for people I don't see on a regular basis. Just so you sort of put a letter insert in, keeping up to date with what's happened.
Yeah, nice.
But for people I see all the time, actually, I shouldn't send them a card, should I?
Well, no, exactly. I don't know. I that's what I question. I think if you're going to buy someone a card, it's nice if you've got something to write in it, as opposed to just, happy birthday,
ask Chloe.
Love Hannah.
Or ask Chloe.
Ask Chloe, yes, exactly. Do you think about writing more in cards or not necessarily?
No, I'm very boring. It's happy birthday, lots of love, hope you have a nice day. And
fair enough.
That's it.
Yeah, but at least that's you writing it and not somebody else.
It's definitely from me, yeah.
Do you want happy birthday from Chloe or not?
No, I don't want from Chloe. Nearly all couples now live together in a trial marriage before choosing to finally tie the knot. Data shows that more than 9 in 10 couples who got married in a civil ceremony in 2022 had cohabited prior to the wedding. Just looking back in time a little bit, 1994, only 59.6% of couples shared a home before marriage. See, I can't imagine getting married before living together.
I don't think people are having trial marriages. I think it's all to do with economy. It's cheaper to live together and then they're saving up. But a lot of those don't survive the marriage, do they?
No, true. But I mean, back in the day, it was more traditional, wasn't it? Many, many years ago.
Do you think it's religious? The 1% that don't? Because it just doesn't make any sense to...
No.
I would have said it was higher. I would have... I didn't get higher than 9 out of 10. But, I'm surprised that there's... You know,
as much as 1%. Yeah,
it was so frowned upon then. I mean, it's, you know, it has everything. Opinions have changed now.
Yeah,
and it's much more acceptable.
Because wedding presents traditionally were toasters and kettles, yeah, because you were moving into your first home together. Mm. But now couples, most couples have lived together for a long time before they get married. So
they just want checks.
Kind of, yeah, just yeah. want money.
Money for a holiday.
Exactly, that's what I did. Yeah.
Definitely.
But yeah, I can't, no, I can't imagine. I mean,
it doesn't seem unusual or out of the ordinary that people live together now.
No,
it's so
exactly.
acceptable.
It's so and normal. It's, it would and be weird the other way around.
Yeah,
I
don't think yeah. of it as pre-marriage, though. It's just they're living together.
Yeah.
It's not like yeah, exactly. it's not as if it's leading on to something else.
No,
it is enough in itself.
You could live together without getting married, mm. couldn't you?
Mm. As long as you've got
a
dog.
High percentage that don't actually carry on and get married.
Yeah.
There's
yeah.
not a need no. now to get married like they used to be.
I think living with someone's a bigger test because you don't really know much about them until you've lived with them. Silly things like where they leave their dirty washing.
Exactly.
Do they put it in the washing basket or do they leave it by the bed?
Yeah.
It's, yeah, I think you really get to know someone when you live with them because you're spending a lot of time with them.
Definitely.
So if they put their washing in the basket, you'd stay with them, but if they put it back in the bed, you wouldn't.
Yes.
Brilliant. But it's true, isn't it? You could live with someone thinking at some stage maybe it'll lead to marriage, but the living together could go all kinds of wrong, and then you'll think, yep, definitely not going to marry this one, you know.
Cause it's but what about arranged marriages? And they seem to last.
Well, yes. I think I never forget, I interviewed an Indian man who talked about arranged marriages years ago. And he said, the problem with you Westerners is that your wedding day is when you're most in love. You look your best, you feel your best. Love is at its peak, and you spend the rest of your marriage trying to go back to how perfect everything was on your wedding day. Women are, you know, losing weight, trying to get back to their wedding weight, and oh, didn't we look at each other in the right kind of way? And but whereas with an arranged marriage, it's just the start of your journey.
Yeah,
you then start to learn about each other, and the love grows as the marriage goes. And I thought that was fascinating. Really interesting
yes,
way
I've,
of looking
I've
at it.
I've heard that before from some of my Asian friends. They say that they love develops.
Yeah, exactly, which makes sense. Mm. It's just different to what we know,
they
isn't it?
Could develop as well. You could find them.
That's
you
can both ways. Can go both ways. Definitely, definitely. Okay. This is a fascinating one. This came from a lady at work. I won't say who, not that it matters. But talking about multiple WhatsApp groups with your partner for different things. She was saying that she had this with her husband, and I thought this was fascinating. I'd never thought about this. And initially I thought this sounded like utter madness, but then she explained why it was a great idea. And I thought, yeah, I kind of get this. So she and her husband have multiple WhatsApp groups for different things. So if she sees a recipe or something that she thinks would be nice for them to have for dinner over the weekend, she'll send it in the WhatsApp group that have the recipes and stuff. If she finds information about a holiday that she thinks would be great to go in, or an Airbnb that's a good price or something like that, that would go in a different WhatsApp group. They do a lot of hiking, cycling trails, things like that. That would go in a different WhatsApp group. And initially I thought, why would you want so many different WhatsApp groups? But from the point of view of trying to find messages again so much easier, instead of having to scroll back, thinking, where was that thing I sent about? It's all in the right place. And I thought, that actually makes a lot of sense.
It sounds as if it's a lot of work when you say it like that, multiple WhatsApp groups. But actually, you're not going to be sending millions of messages.
No.
It's only as and when necessary.
Yeah, exactly. So it's from the point of view of finding it.
So it's a filing system.
Yeah. Mm. I thought that made a lot. So I just wondered if anyone else had multiple WhatsApp groups with their partner.
No. I've got Alexa shopping lists.
Because it makes so much sense when she said this, but I'm yet to find anyone else who has multiple WhatsApp.
No. Multiple WhatsApp groups with different people with different interests.
Yes, different things. But
I think it's a little overkill, to be honest. I think, I think this technology is brilliant nowadays that you can actually search. So, for example, a recipe, say it's chicken tikka masala, you can search that and then it'll pull it up.
Yes,
it filters it and it takes it back to that message.
Maybe she doesn't know this.
Yeah.
It's because if you just put a search in the search at the top, you can put what it is you're looking for.
Yes, you can't you? I'm gonna see if she knows. I'm gonna take a break.
Should we write to her?
Yeah. WhatsApp. Let's set up a WhatsApp group.
Hannah Murray, TRE in the afternoon.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the last part of Women Talk with me in the studio today, Laurie Knight, Kaylee Parkinson and Sandra Mole. There's an article here with the headline, "How dare my husband's ex-wife still use his name, especially as she lives in the same village?" There's various women here who are giving their opinions, most of whom have kept the surname of their ex-husband. They're all quite kind of bitter in some way. One have said, "Betrayed and grieving, I ditched it." One said, "I changed my name for my third wedding." Another said, "His ex-wife still uses it, which drives me mad." One says, "35 years on, I'm still using my married name." So all kind of different things, but a lot of them have kind of issues with the situation, and therefore there's a reason. I'm not kind of sure how I feel about this, because my husband's ex-wife still uses his surname, and I actually never officially took his surname. So his surname's Lopez, and I was really excited about being a Lopez, but everyone, even though I love Murray, I thought, Lopez, that's a great surname for being in Spain, but everyone said, "Oh, it's a nightmare changing your name here, you have to do this," you know, and said it was an absolute nightmare and just completely put me off. And I kind of thought, well, does it matter? So I'm still, everyone suggested I should still stay Hannah Murray on the radio, so I never changed my name. So the fact that she hasn't doesn't really bother me. I hadn't really thought about it, to be honest.
But surely once you're married, it does become your name.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, if you take on your husband's name, whether I agree with that or not, is irrelevant, but it becomes your name.
Yeah.
So it's your right. And there's no reason for you to change it. You can choose to, but there is no reason for you to. And especially if you have children, it can be a bit complicated, I suppose.
Yeah.
But it's a family name. If you have children, I didn't change my name when I got divorced because I want the same name as my children. So,
yeah.
And I also didn't like my maiden name, so that, going back to it, wasn't really an option. But I don't. It's a name. There are more people, unless you've got a very unusual name or there's a reason why you shouldn't have that name. But, there are so many people with the same surname. Does it really matter that somebody's ex has got the same surname?
Yeah,
I think somebody who has a problem with it has a problem.
Has a problem.
Yeah. I was going to say that the person that's saying she's really annoyed by it obviously doesn't like her husband's ex-wife and therefore has an issue with her more than the name, I suppose. Because I kind of don't understand why it's an issue.
But they got married and she knew that he'd been married before. So, she really didn't like it. You've got decisions, you've got choices.
Exactly.
Unless she was still using his credit card, of course.
Slightly different, yes. On to the subject of kids and smartphones. We spoke a little bit about this last week, and I always think it's an interesting subject. This was an article written by Tanya Gold, who said, "Why I will never buy my 11-year-old a smartphone." And I just wanted to read a couple of things she reads as she says here. "My son is nearly 11 and about to start senior school. He gets screen time once a week, but only if he does his chores. And I've noticed he is most likely to be grumpy after it. So no, despite considerable pressure to do so, I will not be buying him a smartphone when he starts big school. 20 head teachers in St Albans ask parents not to buy their children a smartphone until they're 14. I'm going further. My son can't have one until he's 18 and he must buy it himself."
Good for her.
She's a dictator.
I mean, she'll love carrying that out. It's difficult.
It sounds a bit harsh, doesn't it?
Peer pressure.
I don't think kids should have smartphones in school. I think that's not right. However, there is a safety element as well. And when they're out on their own, they can be useful.
Yes, it's absolutely. Walking home.
But do they need a smartphone? There's a difference between having a phone that you can
a
smartphone. And also you've got, if it's an expensive smartphone, you've also got the chance that somebody's going to get pinched and attacked because of it.
It must be so difficult for parents though with the peer pressure. If all of their kids have got a smartphone and you send your kid to school with a little Sony Ericsson or something.
Yeah, but
I used to do that.
Tell us.
My son was not the best of behaved in school. So he had a phone. We're talking a few years ago now. So he used to have a wasn't quite a smartphone because it is a few years ago. But it did more things. It played games, and so when he misbehaved, to take his phone off him.
Yeah,
he was devastated, but he had to have a phone because I used to have to pick him up from school. I used to be able to have to contact him. So we bought him one of the little Nokia bricks. That the yeah. only thing we could do on it was contact him, yeah. or he could message, and it did him no harm. It was an incentive for him to behave himself.
Yeah. So did it work?
No.
He's addicted to it now.
Yeah, he's still gets grumpy.
Funny. We grew up without phones, and now suddenly they're a necessity, and being able to contact kids and stuff again, we weren't contactable when we didn't have phones, but now it's just so normal, isn't it, to be that parent that says no, you're not having a phone when everyone else has one. Must be really hard.
We seem to think that it's much more dangerous now as well, that phones are a necessity for kids coming back and forth.
I think because of phones, we know more. I don't think things have changed a lot. We just know what's going on now. We know that there's things happening. We know that people are getting mugged, and I think there always have been, but we just didn't know about them. But because of phones,
aren't they getting mugged for the smartphones now?
Yeah, the irony. Yes, yeah. Sitting there reading about people nicking phones, and then your phone gets nicked. Yeah. Okay, this is an interesting one. I used to love my 6'4" son being at home, but now he's 29, makes a terrible mess, eats all my food, cramps my sex life, and still won't move out. I just feel utter resentment. How old is too old to be living at home?
18.
You didn't even need to think about that.
No. Love all my children to bits, but I moved to Spain to get away from them.
Yeah. So was it 18?
No, that's not quite. I always thought that 18, that you would be free, that they would move on, they would go to university, but they keep coming back. And you think that financially you'll be separated from them, but no, the things get more expensive that they need and they want, and so I totally agree with that idea. To have them living at home with you, and when my children come over, they go into child mode. Although they live on their own, they do all their washing, they do everything for themselves. But as soon as they come to me, it's like, oh, Mum, can you just? It's like, oh. So I totally understand.
Yeah,
my mum used to call us yo-yos because we were always back and forth.
Yeah. Funny, yes. Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, with the cost of living and all of that, you know, I feel for youngsters and their parents when the kids, you know, can't afford to get a home and can't afford to pay rent and all that kind of stuff.
Having respect as well. It's one thing living with your child, but if they use it as a
hotel,
you know, you're still expected to do the washing, still pick the washing up from the floor and everything else, then, you know, and at 29...
Yeah,
it does tend to be boys that stay at home longer, though, isn't it? Doesn't it?
Yeah, I think there seems to be more of a kind of trend with that.
It's very difficult to women living in the same house that have strong opinions and want to do.
Yeah,
I struggled with my eldest daughter because she wanted to be independent, but she also wanted to be a child as well, and I found that difficult. To me, she was a child, and it was my house, my rules, but she was an adult, so she wanted to do things her way.
Well,
you know, find your own place and do things your own way. Don't, you know, in my house, you do what I want you to do.
Yeah, difficult. Yeah. Very difficult.
We couldn't live together.
No. It's interesting, that relationship between mother and daughter, isn't it? It's well documented over the years. It can be, you know, it can be a kind of a tricky thing. You can be the best of friends and then not. Basically.
Best of friends, but don't live together.
Yeah, just meet up casually every so often. This is an interesting one. Head teachers are in mutiny over government plans to ban sex education for under nines, saying they're already getting less reliable information elsewhere. School leaders' unions say they need the flexibility to discuss sensitive subjects at young ages because of the harmful content some children are accessing online. So do you remember having sex education at school? How old you are?
No, we didn't have any sex education. No? The pages in our science book were blocked out. I should have been a rabbit, really, because that's all we ever learned. And I think it's ridiculous. We hear this story with every change of government. Sex education comes up and we keep reinventing the wheel. And it's crazy. If you don't give children the right knowledge, they're going to go away. I mean, when I was teaching sex education, some of the teachers didn't even know about sex education.
One
teacher came up to me and said, but you get the first one free, and if you stand up, you can't get pregnant.
Oh, God.
But they are teachers.
Yeah, that's
because
scary.
Not because they're stupid, because sex education wasn't there when they were at school either. Mm.
So how old do you think kids should be getting sex education?
Sex education is age appropriate. And if the child isn't ready to learn about what you're saying, they won't take it in.
Right, interesting.
I remember
levels of sex education, surely.
Yeah.
A child of nine doesn't need to know everything.
No.
You know, there's certain things that maybe they need to know, they're interested in.
More from a biological point of view, I think.
Puberty, hormones, that sort of thing.
They need to know about the correct touch. Who to, you know, what to do, but they don't need to know about intercourse.
No.
But they do need to know about relationships.
Yeah.
And about loving relationships.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. It's a big topic, isn't it? Mm. And there's definitely different stages. I remember playing I remember coming home from work at a very young age, having played reproduction bingo at school at a young age and telling my mum about it and not understanding what any of it meant, but playing bingo and going like, urethra and labia and stuff like that. But they were just words that we played bingo with and didn't know what any of it meant. My mum was like, what? Just shouting out all these words all to do with different parts of the anatomy without really understanding the implications of it or anything. It was great.
Make sex education fun and the kids will remember as well. It's getting rid of the taboo that it's a non-talkable situation, discussion. You can't talk about it.
We've only got 20 seconds left. I remember a programme with Davina McCall years ago when she went into schools in Holland, in the Netherlands, into sex education classes, and all the kids had to put condoms on
bananas.
Yeah, something like that. It was really interesting. Anyway, we'll end it there.
Thank you.
Bye.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this program, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels, and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.